From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The playwright Arthur Miller had heard about the Salem witch trials when he was in college, but it didn't occur to him to write anything about them for years. But then came the communist hysteria of the early 1950s, when blacklists were compiled and people were asked to name names. Miller says he decided to write about Salem in the 17th century as a way of understanding what was happening at the moment, because it seemed impossible to make sense of it in contemporary terms. Miller has said we were all going slightly crazy trying to be honest and trying to see straight and trying to be safe. Today in the program, we're talking about Miller's play, The Crucible, which has just opened at the Pioneer Theater Company. We'll talk about the history of the story and the play and why it still works today. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's easy to see Arthur Miller's play, The Crucible, as an allegory about America in the early 1950s, where the House Un-American Activities Committee was looking for communists and demanding people name names. The play is about the Salem witch trials in 1692, where 20 people were falsely accused of witchcraft and executed in a moment of public hysteria. And while it is true this moment was the trigger for Miller to write his play, the scholar Christopher Bigsby says The Crucible's relevance and success today has little to do with the McCarthy era. It's about much bigger, more personal themes. He says it's a study about guilt, about the seductions of power, about the flawed nature of society and the individual, and that's why it works today. The Crucible has just opened at the Pioneer Theater Company, which is giving us an opportunity to talk about some of these big themes, not to mention the interesting history behind the play. You can join us today if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Charles Morey is with us today. He's the director of the play. He's a playwright himself, of course, the former artistic director of the Pioneer Theater Company. And as I said, he's directing the company's production of The Crucible and joining us here in the studio. And Charles Morey, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Christopher Bigsby is with us today as well, a literary historian and director of the Arthur Miller Center at the University of East Anglia in England, where he is a professor of American Studies. Bigsby is the author of some 50 books, including his recent two-volume biography of Arthur Miller. He's joining us today from the studios of the BBC in Norwich. And Christopher Bigsby, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I guess I wanted to start, Christopher Bigsby, with you and to this question. I guess it's true that The Crucible is Arthur Miller's most frequently produced play. Why do you think that is?
Well, certainly not because it was about the House Un-American Activities Committee. I mean, this is a play that's produced around the world by people who really couldn't give a toss about the 1950s in America. And it's because they enter the play in a different way. Miller used to say he didn't write plays, he wrote metaphors. Mm. And the force of a metaphor is that it can be interpreted differently. So every time a play is performed, of course, it's different because you've got different actors, directors, scene designers and so on, different audience. And it's performed in a different social and political context. So here is a play that could be staged in communist China. And they were not terribly interested, strangely, in the anti-communist phase of the 1950s. Right. they read it as an account of the Cultural Revolution, that period in Chinese history when suddenly children had power over their adults. Mm. They would beat their teachers. They would sometimes kill adults. There was a complete reversal of the culture. And in The Crucible, of course, it is the young, yeah, the children, who gain power in that community, or power is given to them by the assumptions that are made by that society. Now, that's a very particular way of interpreting it. Yeah. But when the play was put on with Liam Neeson as John Proctor in New York after 9/11 and after the Patriot Act was introduced, many people then saw it as in some sense a comment on what was going on in America. You know, you're either with us or against us. Mm-hmm. There was this vague enemy out there. The freedoms that America touted to the world were suddenly suspended. People were picked up, they without trial, without charge. Habeas corpus, which as part of Magna Carta, which we've been celebrating recently, just went out the window immediately. Well, in 1692, there was a perceived sense of crisis. I mean, this is a society that had not really yet established itself. There were all kinds of property disputes going on. There was a theocracy. There was only one reality. Yeah. It's like the Great Gatsby, where Gatsby is accused of looking through a single window. They looked through a single window. And those who looked through different windows or other windows were immediately suspect. Now, that's something that's understood the world around, when you're what you believe in, what you want to say, is at odds with the conventions of that society. And sometimes those conventions are enforced.
I want to come back to some of those themes, because I think they're important to talk about in the context of the play. Charles Morey, let me get your sense of the broader sense of the play. I mean, you've talked about having obviously seen it early in your, you know, career in theater, but I guess it wasn't until you actually directed it that you got it, or at least discovered it in an important way.
Yes, very, very much so. And first of all, I'd say I agree with absolutely everything that your guest says about the play. I think he's dead on accurate. Nobody cares about the House Un-American Activities Committee and its relationship to the play today. It's really a false road, particularly from the point of view of a director or producer of the play. But I think I first came across the play when I was in high school in the mid-1960s. And I know I saw it when I was in high school in a production of the Seattle Repertory Theater. And quite frankly, and I say with a little bit of embarrassment, I fell sound asleep. And it's not that I was a snotty teenager. I thought I was very interested in theater and the arts and literature at that point. But I found the play to be ponderous and slow and tedious. And I believe it was probably the production sorry to anybody who may have seen that or directed it or was in it, who many people I may know now. But it wasn't an end, and I saw other productions of the play early on that could not engage me at all. And I came back to the play actually about the time that I became the artistic director of the Pioneer Theater Company here, and I said, well, I guess I ought to reread that. And I hadn't read it since college, and I went, wow, this is a really good play. And what really makes this play work is simple melodrama. It's pure melodrama, but it's hooked on big, big ideas. But the sense of outrage that is developed in the audience over the course of this play, as the events begin to cascade out of control, and it seems that logic and intelligent argument and presumption of innocence should prevail, they don't. And as you read it or watch it for a first time, your sense of outrage just builds and builds and builds. But of course, it reaches way beyond melodrama in that, I mean, the through line of the play is John Proctor's arc from guilt towards self-knowledge.
Which I want to sort of work through as we go along. Christopher Bigsby, you say Arthur Miller first heard the story of Salem when he was a student at Michigan. But he didn't quite know what to do with it.
I always find it gratifying that anyone learns anything at university. And yes, it stayed in his mind. And the other things actually he studied at university which stayed with him were who's interested in the Greek theatre, the ancient Greek theatre, and in Ibsen. Yeah. And I think they're not irrelevant in some ways. What he found in the classical Greek theatre was a situation in which theatre was thought to be central to the culture, so much so that the rich had to pay taxes so that the poor could go, because it's where you went to see your culture's myths and values staged, that the, your private life was connected with the public life of the society of which you were a part. Mm-hmm. That would stay with Miller. That's very much a part of The Crucible. And what he learned from Ibsen is that the past is not dead. It's rather William Faulknerish, really, that the past is not dead. It's not even the past. And that's in an American society, which I have to say from the a European perspective, has a certain contempt for history, partly because it leans into the future. It's an immigrant society where the promise is that tomorrow will be different from today. You remember the big campaign, well, you won't remember, but it was a television commercial when Ronald Reagan was running, and the slogan was, "It's always morning in America." Yeah. In other words, every day you reinvent yourself. For Miller, that was nonsense. If you sever the link between the past and the present, you severed a kind of moral link. You sever the link between cause and effect, act and consequence. And he always said of his plays that they're about the chickens coming home to roost. Mm-hmm. And the chickens are coming home to roost with a vengeance in The Crucible.
Yeah. It's interesting. You write, Christopher Bigsby, about this book that Miller encountered in 1949. Marion Starkey had written a book called The Devil in Massachusetts, which really got Arthur Miller thinking about this in a different way. And what I found interesting about your telling of that was that he wasn't necessarily, I mean, obviously it was the trigger, the McCarthy era, because he was involved in that, which we'll get to, but he was also thinking about these pseudo-scientific concepts about race and about nationality and ideology, and we weren't that far away from, of course, World War II and the Holocaust, and this was also on his mind.
Yes, I asked him about that specifically, and he said, absolutely, it is. And if you remember, of course, in Nazi Germany, they had the pseudoscience in which how you would identify a Jew, and the Jew was thought was presumed to be a threat to the society. That was the myth that they were then enacting, and yes, that was very, very close in his mind, being himself Jewish. And that was when we talk about the House Un-American Activities Committee, the Jewishness of that attack is interesting. The fact that so many people who they summoned before them were Jewish. It hadn't gone away, and that did make a link in his mind. The interesting thing about that book, Marion Starkey, is that she herself saw the drama of it, the potential drama of it. And of course, there's almost a play within a play in The Crucible, because the trial is a form of drama. There are people who are deliberately performing roles. Abigail is taking on a role. She's actually providing the words, the script, for some of the people around her. So there is a conscious attempt to create and structure a drama by the characters within that, as well as it being a major and powerful drama in its own right.
You had mentioned, I do want to set up the story so we can put that context in relationship to the things that we're talking about. I mentioned sort of 1692, 19 men and women, and as I read about this, apparently two dogs were also convicted and, yes, and hanged for witchcraft.
Well, they were naughty. They were wicked.
One man was pressed. He figures in the play, which is crushed to death, basically, for his role. Now, Charles Morey, maybe set this play up for us. This is the public hysteria, and we'll get to some of the particular characters as we go. But give us a general sense of what's happening.
Well, at first we discover a young girl who seems to be in the throes of some sort of adolescent hysteria, and her father and the rest of the community who cannot make any sense of it. And there are those who immediately wish to leap to the notion of witchcraft. And those who are making the accusations also have grievances of their own with other members of the community over property, over animals, over the conduct of the church itself, and then we understand very quickly that John Proctor and one of the young girls who was caught by the Reverend dancing in the woods by moonlight has had an affair with John Proctor, and she is deeply smitten with him. And ultimately, in order to avoid taking any responsibility for her part in this dancing in the wood and that sort of thing, she begins to cry out witches, and the other girls join. This is a vast simplification.
Of course. I just wanted to get the basic sense of it, though, because I think that's important. I wonder, Christopher Bigsby, you write about how John Proctor becomes the center of the story, that Arthur Miller believed that it had to be, and this maybe gets to what Marion Starkey was talking about, that it's not just this big broad thing, that it's about a tragedy. That, and I think that this is what Arthur Miller said, is that I have to find a tragedy, because it has to be not just a tragedy for the community. I think you've written it has to be a tragedy for an individual.
Yes. I mean, it. As far as John Proctor is concerned, it begins with a different kind of guilt. He's betrayed his wife.
Right.
He's had a brief sexual encounter with Abigail, which of course he couldn't have done historically, because one hopes, because the original Proctor was 60 and Abigail was 11.
Right. Yeah.
So he deliberately, you know, made Proctor 35 and Abigail 17, because he wanted that sexuality, which was going to be important elsewhere in the play.
Right.
So he begins with a private guilt, and it's that private guilt that inhibits him in some way from stepping into the public arena.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The sexuality is important. Of course, this whole business of examining witches was sexual. They would, and it was very often aimed at women. It was women they were after. And one of the things that they did, not in the play, but in actuality, was to strip women naked in order to find the marks of the devil. And that might be a supernumerary nipple, or it might be a scar, or a birthmark, or whatever it is. But they stripped them naked. One of the reasons where he saw a parallel between this and Clinton's encounter with Monica Lewinsky, and the way the special prosecutor and congressman would talk openly about sex on television and on radio, unashamedly, because they had the cover of an apparent crime that had been committed. So that it was the lasciviousness of it that drew them to that event with Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. And incidentally, he appeared on a television show with Monica Lewinsky.
Wow.
Rather strangely. But so it's not arbitrary that he has had a sexual betrayal, and that sexuality pervades the play. I might say it was one of the reasons the British theatre, which was pretty moribund at this time, really received American drama as well as it did, because there was a frank sexuality about the American theatre that there simply wasn't about the British things. It could be front and centre. And sexual betrayal is so frequent in those plays. Death of a Salesman,
right.
Willie Loman has been off with a woman. In All My Son, somebody wants to marry the fiancé of his dead brother. In A View from the Bridge, a man really is sexually drawn towards somebody he shouldn't be drawn towards. That kind of, and I think this is one of the reasons people can pick on this play in any culture, because those notions of betrayal and denial, self-preservation, are things that people understand and recognize, not in those absolute terms of this kind of a drama, but in private life, in ordinary life, there are daily betrayals and denials, the desire to make somebody else guilty, because that's the only way you yourself can prove your innocence. Mm-hmm. And I think that was at large in America. I can't help thinking of George W. Bush, who would stand up in his public speeches and tell Americans how good they were. Why would you tell the American people that they're good unless there was a slight suspicion that they're not? And And also, of course, to make the rest of the world live in darkness and sin by contrast. Hence, you know, the city on the hill. You can only have a city on the hill if they're looking down on everybody else. And that was a period, of course, in which there very much was a Manichaean world in George W. Bush's world. You were either good or you were evil. And there was going to be an axis of evil.
Christopher Bigsby is with us, a literary historian, director of the Arthur Miller Center at the University of East Anglia in England, joining us from the studios of the BBC in Norwich this morning. Charles Morey is with us. He directed he's former artistic director of the Pioneer Theatre Company, you probably all recall. He's directing the company's production of The Crucible, which opened over the weekend. We'll give you the details about getting tickets a little bit later on the program. We need to take a brief break, though. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the latest production from the Pioneer Theatre Company. It's Arthur Miller's classic play, The Crucible. Charles Morey is directing the play. He says it may be the great American tragedy. The Crucible is about the Salem witch trials in the 17th century in Massachusetts. Miller wrote the play in the heat of the McCarthy era when thousands of Americans were being accused of being communist or communist sympathizers. That's just one of the cases, though, that makes this play relevant today. It's about much more than that. Christopher Bigsby is with us. He's a literary historian, director of the Arthur Miller Center at the University of East Anglia in England, the author of numerous books, including a recent two-volume biography of Arthur Miller, joining us today from the studios of the BBC in Norwich, England. And Charles Morey is with us, as I mentioned, the director. He's a director and a playwright. He directed the play, and he's joining us here in the studio. Christopher Bigsby, you say that what is at stake, really, in this play, or one of the things, anyway, in Salem itself is the survival of this sense of community. And you've said, in effect, what's going on is this preoccupation with fear and blame really makes the community in Salem stop functioning. Would you talk more about that?
Yes. In a version of the play and in an early script for the film version, the Daniel Day-Lewis film version, he actually had scenes of the desolation because people were literally taken off the farm and put into court. Who the hell was going to milk the cows or look after the fields? It was actually physically an attack on the society. The society was at risk of disintegrating and falling apart. And, of course, the parallel with the 50s is a kind of inversion of normal values. So betrayal becomes a civic responsibility in the 50s, and it does in this play. And betrayal is a route to redemption. And it's an attack on loyalties, on trust. Any society relies on a kind of mutuality of trust. Trust is exactly what is eroded. And what was being eroded in a terrible way in the 1950s, I mean, a lot of people lost their jobs. Some people lost their lives, committed suicide. Since I'm from a university, I have to remind people that people were thrown out of universities because their views were not in accord with the views that were being propounded at the moment. Some universities resisted. University of Utah, in fact, resisted moves for a loyalty oath, although Brigham Young there had a very right-wing president, anti-communist. Famously, there were a group of student spies who reported on the faculty. Now, that erodes fundamental trust there between a teacher and a student. But in the broader society, how can any society function when betrayal is thought to be a virtue?
It's interesting because this is another one of those things that makes this play seem relevant. I mean, if you look at the American political dilemma today, I mean, you have, you know, fear being used as a weapon. You have factionalism to the degree that really little actual governing is actually getting done. I mean, at least however you find yourself, wherever you find yourself on that sort of political spectrum, I think everyone can agree there's not much getting done. And I wonder, Charles Moore, if you see that as a kind of one of those relevant things that makes this play connect even more.
Well, certainly we respond
viscerally to these to what we experience on a daily life of sort of right wing religious hysteria and the sense of that this must be a Christian country and we all must kind of conform to those values. I mean, that becomes very resonant today in ways that when I first directed the play over 20 years ago were not quite so prominent. The whole notion that I think is central to the play, the demonization of the other. Anybody who doesn't think like us, who isn't kind of one of us, is to be demonized. I mean, Danforth has this really chilling statement.
And mention who he is.
Deputy Governor Danforth is the chief judge, yes, really, who's conducting this the witch hunts, really. And he says, and I hope I quote it correctly, something to the effect of, it's your soul that's at issue here. Unless you prove its whiteness, you cannot live in a Christian country. Which is chilling both from a legal point of view in terms of presumption of innocence and from a social and theological point of view in terms of tolerance of religious belief. And it comes right down to, I think, what we see happening in our own culture in many ways.
Christopher Biggs, you say, aside from the practical things that are falling apart in Salem, Miller is really concerned with the breaking of the social contract that binds the community together. The idea of, as I think you were talking about, trust but also love and mutual respect. I mean, so the McCarthy era may have been a trigger for Arthur Miller, but you say he was less interested in that part as the human ones, that common experience of humanity.
Well, he was. That you have to. I mean, I write program notes for The Crucible, and despite what I've said, I always feel obliged to say something about the House on American Activities Committee, because he really wrote this play in white heat. Yeah. It was news that he wanted to get out there. The betrayals were very close to home. I mean, in 1952, on the eve of him going up to Salem to research it, he had a phone call from Ilya Kazan, who directed Salesman, to say that he was going to name names. Lee J. Cobb, who played Willie Loman, named names. Clifford Odets, the playwright he admired most of all, named names. And when he went up to Salem and researched, he saw all the names listed of people who had been betrayed. And on the way back from Salem, he turned on the car radio and he heard the names that Kazan had offered up. The parallel, he said, was so close that it was frightening. I talked to one of the people who Kazan named, Phoebe Konosky, and she said there were two people she hated. One was Adolf Hitler and the other one was Ilya Kazan, because it destroyed her and it destroyed their theatre company that she had run. There was a price to be paid, and it was partly paid by the people who did the betraying. I don't think Kazan ever got it out of his system that he had done that. But of course, it was paid on a much larger scale by the people who were named, and Miller famously refused to name names. He wasn't the only one who, Pete Seeger refused to name names and offered to sing a song instead.
Yeah. There's a wonderful section in Miller's autobiographical Time Bends about in which he recounts being on his way up to Salem to start his research and starting and stopping to see the Kazans on the way and having a long discussion about what Kazan was about to do in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee.
You know, what's interesting, you write about, this seemed odd to me, Christopher Bigsby, that the Kazans, one of their problems with the play was making the connection between communists and witches, that witches didn't exist, but communists did. Do you want to say something about that?
Well, that was the accusation leveled at the play by a number of critics. The play had a very modest run. It was attacked by a number of critics, and one of the lines was that the parallel is not a real one, because there were communists and there weren't witches. But Miller points out, actually, the play itself accepts the fact that there is such a thing as witches. Tituba conjures at the beginning. She is a witch in that sense. But he said also, if you'd stood up in 17th century New England and said there was no such thing, there were no such things as witches, you would immediately be on your way to the cells.
Right.
That would have been equally true in England. I mean, these were Puritans. These were people of the book. And that's the important thing. There was one text. There was one authorized text. If you strayed outside that text, you were in trouble. Remember, John Proctor says, I speak my soul. And you're not allowed to do that. Yeah. The Quakers, I speak my heart, he says.
Yeah. What are we, Quakers here?
Yeah, yeah. Quakers did that. And what happened to the Quakers? They were hanged on Boston Common for speaking their heart. Yeah. You don't speak your heart in a repressive society. Miller had been a communist earlier on. You certainly didn't speak your heart in the Soviet Union. It's not only America where you have to be careful what you say and when you say it. In later years, he was the president of International Pen, and he would go to Russia and he would go to what was then Czechoslovakia, and there would be microphones. Václav Havel in Czechoslovakia had a microphone concealed in the ceiling. He took it out and took it to the police because he said, I think this is your property. you could not speak freely. In fact, Miller later on wrote a play called The Archbishop's Ceiling, mm-hmm. in which there are writers in an old archbishop's palace, which is clearly in Prague, and there may or may not be microphones concealed in the ceiling. So part of the time they behave as though there are, and therefore they're performing. They're performing from an invisible audience. Mm-hmm. Part of the time they forget. Remember Richard Nixon and the recordings mm-hmm. which he made? Some of the times he was playing to the microphone, sometimes not. Now, I'll tell you a very quick story about this. I went to Salzburg with Arthur Miller. We took the cast of Death of a Salesman from the National for a seminar there. Mm. And I interviewed him, and the people from Salzburg came in. And Arthur and I went into the library while they came in, and we talked about how there must be a bunch of old Nazis coming in. What we had forgotten was that we were wearing radio microphones. And although it didn't get broadcast, when Austrian television sent me the tape at the beginning, they left on the conversation.
Wow.
Just so that we knew. So, and this, where was this building we were performing in? It was an archbishop's palace.
Yeah.
We had actually replicated what he had in the play. Speech is not free in certain societies. Mm. It wasn't in 1692. It wasn't in 1950s America. It wasn't in the Soviet Union. And it isn't in a lot of places now. Not in Denmark, it appears. Not in France, it appears. And what about those campuses on a very low level in which they don't allow certain writers to come on the campus because they don't like their opinions?
Mm-hmm.
Do we really protect free speech, even in universities, which you think would be the bastion of it? And what is political correctness? We do it out of the best of motives, but we police our own language because at this moment that is thought to be important. 10 years, 20 years time, that may seem absurd. I don't know. That's very low level, and maybe I shouldn't invoke it. But but speech is not free.
It's low level, but it's very real.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's another aspect of the story I wanted to ask you about. The idea that Arthur Miller, as he's listening to these trials, or these hearings, I guess better to put it that way, the hearings of the House Committee, that he was hearing something that he described as avowedly ritualistic, and the same kind, and you've written about this, Christopher Bigsby, that he was hearing things like, words like diabolical, the denial of God, not just in the House Un-American Activities Committee, but the Rosenberg trial, for example. I mean, you heard this kind of God in kind of language invoked from time to time at the during the era.
Yes, they were, and they were selling indulgences. That's to say, if you did what they wanted you to do, you could be purged of your guilt and your sin, and all you had to do was betray other people, and then you would be redeemed. It was suffused with that kind of language, but then we are talking about America, an alleged secular society, but which is obsessively religious.
When we get back from the break, I want to talk about Charles Morey, the challenges of staging a play like this, and also about the language. Christopher Bigsby's written about Arthur Miller's language. Christopher Bigsby is with us. He is a professor of American Studies, Author of 50 books, including a two-volume biography of Arthur Miller. He's joining us from the studios of the BBC in Norwich. We also have Charles Morey with us. He's a director and a playwright. He is the he's directing the Pioneer Theatre Company's production of The Crucible, which just opened over the weekend, runs through February 28th. You can get details and information on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the latest production from the Pioneer Theatre Company. It's Arthur Miller's classic play, The Crucible. We have the director, Charles Morey, with us. We also have the scholar, Christopher Bigsby, joining us from the studios of the BBC in Norwich. I wondered, Christopher Bigsby, you write about the language in the play, and what an achievement it was for Arthur Miller to be able to, as you explain it, make the 17th century seem both distant and close. Mm-hmm. Would you talk about that?
Yes, it is not that he goes back and replicates the actual language that was used. What he has to do is to create a language which we believe these people would speak. Mm-hmm. When he was writing The Crucible, he was writing parts of it in verse. Wow. Little bits of Death of a Salesman, when he was writing that, mm-hmm. were in verse. He wrote verse dramas for American radio when he couldn't get into the theatre. And he did that because it was a way of controlling language, of boiling it down. That famous line in Death of a Salesman, attention, attention must be paid, which some people thought was Jewish. He said, no, that's emergency language. Mm-hmm. I want you to be riveted by that line. It's like the John Donne line, high on a hill truth stand, and he that will reach it about must and about must go. It forces you to do something. It is an artificial language, but one which is, to my mind, wholly believable.
How do you approach it as a director, Charles Morey?
Well, I would agree with that. It's wholly believable, and it is an artificial. It's a made-up syntax. And it is like, for American actors, it's like playing any of the classics. It's a heightened language, and you have to fill it emotionally and have to fill it vocally. It's difficult for the actors because there are a lot of inversions there, changes of noun-verb order and syntactical oddities. And it's difficult for them to learn, but they all really respect the language and kind of love to chew on it. So they work very hard at being as close to word perfect as is possible.
Does a certain rhythm develop?
There is a rhythm, and there are parts of it that feel that lift towards the poetic, certainly. Mm-hmm. Certainly in some of Proctor's later speeches, and also Danforth as well. It's a heightened language. It's a very rich language, and it tells us as audience long ago, far away, but we understand it completely. There's nothing, there's no difficulty in it as you might find in a true 18th century or 17th century play that that audiences might have difficulty understanding.
Yeah. I want to get to this question of guilt. It's another one of these themes that we've sort of referred to, but I did wonder, Christopher Bigsby, in your conversations with Arthur Miller, did you ever raise the matter of his own affair with Marilyn Monroe as one of those motivating factors that at least he plugged into as he was thinking about writing this
Yes,
play?
I did. By now he had met Marilyn Monroe, and they are both quite plainly, that was in sort of January of 1951, and he was writing The Crucible in 1952, produced in 1953. He had almost run away from Marilyn Monroe, if you can actually believe that. I mean, he was married, of course.
Yeah.
So he was going back to his wife. He was just terrified of the feelings that he was having. She fell for him, which is even more remarkable. But then he was a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright who had told her that she should be in the theatre, that she was a real actress. And that's exactly what she wanted to hear. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, she pursued him. She wrote letters to him, and she went to New York and was in a hotel room and told him she'd be there, waited for him, and he never came. Wow. But he had been dismantled emotionally, sexually, I suppose, in some ways, though nothing had yet happened. So here is a play in which an older man and a younger woman have a relationship, and the older man is in a cold relationship with his wife, and I'm afraid that's how Miller felt his relationship with Mary had become. They spent 2 years in therapy to try and keep their marriage going, and the therapist ended up by telling Arthur Miller he could solve the problem in one go. All he had to do was stop writing, because it was the writing and the theatre world that was drawing him away, because Mary didn't like any of that world, actors, directors, the fame. She didn't want any of that, and their relationship was cold. So, yes, I hate even to mention Marilyn in relation to this, because so many people, you say Arthur Miller, and they say, wasn't he married to Marilyn Monroe? No. Yes, he was for 4.5 years, and he was married to Inga Murat for 40 years.
Right. Yes.
And she was a brilliant woman, spoke 6 languages, was a magnum photographer. Somehow she disappears. To me, she's far, far more important than Marilyn. But yes, that sexuality, that sense of betrayal was something Miller knew in his own life right at that moment when he was writing this play.
It's also true, of course, of Death of a Salesman. Willie Loman is, as you've put it, Christopher Bigby, rendered powerless because of guilt. This sense of guilt is a very powerful...
it is. And for Miller, guilt is fine if it turns into responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Guilt is self-referring. It isolates you. If you can transform it into responsibility, then it becomes a social issue. Mm-hmm. You're engaging with others. You're not. It's not denial. Denial is a fatal thing. And I would think the fundamental themes of Miller are betrayal and denial, because he sees it in all circumstances, in private life and in public life. He didn't believe the two were separate. I mean, famously, he would say the fish is in the sea and the sea is in the fish. The individual is in society, but society has already been incorporated in the individual. You can't separate them out, which is why his plays are social plays, but they're also private plays, about private anguish. And that's why people, I think, respond to Arthur Miller's play. They don't respond to ideas. They don't go and see the play because they want to know about ideas. It's because they recognize the dilemmas of the individuals. Yeah. They know about fathers and sons, about husbands and wives. They know about the small betrayals, the small denials. That's part of their lives. They recognize and they respond. They respond emotionally. I think the intellectual bit comes afterwards. I went to see Death of a Salesman with Arthur Miller and with my wife, and when she came out, she'd been crying at the end of Salesman, and he bent down to her and said, never wear mascara to one of my plays.
How are you thinking about the idea? I guess that's, of course, if you're a director, forget the big metaphor and the allegory. I've got to get these actors to pay attention to those particular...
You've got to make it visceral, moment by moment by moment, and engage the audience viscerally, moment by moment. And that's the power of the play. You're not responding viscerally to the ideas. The ideas are there, and they resonate, and they lift the emotion, and certainly in reflection you come back to it. But it's trying to make each moment emotionally powerful and make that make John Proctor's arc emotionally clear and strong and something, and that the audience will respond to with enormous empathy.
You go to Tom Stoppard play for the ideas. You see Arcadia. It's not the characters you engage with.
Yeah.
It is actually the idea at the heart of it. It's the intellectual finesse that you go for, but not in Arthur Miller. Mm. It's there, and you absorb it, and it's only afterwards, I think, that you put all these pieces together and realise what it is you've been seeing. And The Crucible is much closer to being a tragedy than Death of a Salesman, about which he famously wrote an essay, because the trouble with Willie Loman is he goes out at the end with the same illusions that he's had all the way through.
Yeah.
He dies not in despair, but in hope, because he hopes that the next generation will have the same fantasies he had. But John Proctor, there comes a moment when a full realization comes home and he accepts responsibility. Guilt is transformed into responsibility because he's asked to sign his name to a document. It's one thing telling a lie and going along with what's required of him. It's another to sign it because it becomes a public act which will have consequences for other people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that he cannot and will not do, in the same way that Arthur Miller later, using some of the same words almost that Proctor used, refused to sign because he would be endangering other people.
It's Charles Moore, would you talk about this moment in the play? Because as I'm looking at it here on the page, Proctor, and then Arthur Miller writes this little stage direction. He says, with a cry of his whole soul. And Proctor says, because it is my, he's refused to, he originally decides he's going to confess, mm-hmm. He wants his life, as he
yes.
says. But then in the end, he doesn't. He says, because it is my name. Will you talk about the power of this moment?
It's a remarkably powerful moment. And it's exactly as Christopher was saying, it's not one that you can sort of put together as an intellectual step-by-step point. It's he comes to this, he's searching for ways to try to explain why he viscerally, why emotionally, I cannot give you this piece of paper. Why can't I do it? An earlier stage direction, Miller says, almost like a child. He's just, I won't do it, I won't do it. And he can't quite come to that. And then finally, he comes to because it is my name.
Yeah.
And for me in that moment, because it is my name, because I can have no other in my life, it's him, as was said, accepting his guilt, transferring guilt to responsibility, mm-hmm. but also in that moment, I think it says, I know who I am.
Yeah.
I know what a man is. And it's an incredibly powerful moment. Particularly, you see him in the scene before with his wife. This is a broken, broken man. 3 months chained in a dungeon, and you can just imagine him in the pangs of guilt that he's been living with for those 3 months. He's utterly broken. And he says, "I will confess," and then he says, "I cannot because it is my name." It's one of the most powerful moments in the American theater.
Is it Christopher Bigsby? He's asking. He comes to the idea. This is the meaning of my life. Is that what he's getting at there?
Yes. I mean, there in all of those first four plays, there comes a moment when the characters shout out their name,
mm-hmm.
and it's usually the moment when they're betraying it. I'm Willie Loman. I'm not a dime a dozen, and mm-hmm. so on. I'm Eddie Carbone. In this case, he's actually discovered who he is. He has accepted who he is. I have a confession to make. I read on the website that various people in Salt Lake City are tracing their forebears back to Salem. I have a connection too. One of my forebears, Bridget Bigsby, was hanged as a witch in Suffolk, here in England, in 1645,
wow. mm-hmm.
about 40 miles from where I'm now speaking. The evidence was she was seen talking to a mouse. Another of mine was called Hannah Bigsby, and she gave evidence alongside Mary Warren before Governor Hathorne at the Salem trials, and the man was hanged. So one of my forebears was an accuser, and one was the accused, one was a betrayer, one was the betrayed. And I think, in a sense, the Crucible is saying we have the capacity for being both,
yes,
or either, and there comes a moment when we have to decide which way we're going to step.
And I think the ultimate power of the Crucible, particularly for an American audience, is the reflection of ourselves in that. We see our present culture in a direct line from that Puritan tradition, and we can trace it step by step by step up to the present day, as you were referring to earlier.
Let me ask you, Christopher Bigsby, one of the things that you you've written about was just how risky this might have been for Arthur Miller in 1953. He himself talked about riding himself into the wilderness politically, but also personally.
Yes, I think people assume that he got into political trouble with the Crucible. He was already in political trouble. Despite the success of All My Sons and Death of a Salesman, All My Sons was banned from being produced in American-occupied Europe, post-war Europe, So was Death of a Salesman. Death of a Salesman Road Company was picketed by the American Legion. These were taken as attacks on American capitalism, attacks on the American family. Mm. He was going to make a film about juvenile delinquency when a New York newspaper ran a campaign to get him fired, and he was fired. So even braver to tackle The Crucible and put it out there in the face of these people. He'd already written sort of radical plays earlier on, including an attack on the House Un-American Activities Committee in a little known small play. But yes, there's a certain bravery in confronting America with The Crucible at that moment.
You know, I wanted to ask you finally, I hadn't realized, but I think it took until it was something like 1992 to actually finally exonerate all of the people who had been hanged for witchcraft, to rectify the injustice of it all. Is that true?
Well, there were various stages, including in the 17th, 18th century, when apologies were made. Mm-hmm. But yes, it was indeed in late 20th century that that happened. And a memorial was erected at Salem and actually unveiled the following year by Eli
Kazan. That's right.
Mm-hmm. So the connection with the Holocaust you were mentioning earlier was actually forged in that moment and in that place.
There was an apology and something of a recantation by one of the girls, I can't remember exactly one, who attributed it all to a great delusion of Satan.
I think it was Mary Warren,
was it? Mary? I don't remember exactly.
Yes, they did. Mm-hmm. These were quite ambivalent. And they paid compensation, but they paid compensation to the accusers as well as to the accused, mm-hmm. as though they'd all been the victims of something larger than themselves. There was even compensation for John Proctor, but alas, he was dead.
Christopher Bigsby, he is an Arthur Miller scholar, the author of several books on the playwright, including a recent biography called Arthur Miller. He joined us from the studios of the BBC in Norwich. Christopher Bigsby, thank you very much for the time.
Great pleasure.
Charles Morey, director of Pioneer Theatre Company's production of The Crucible. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
The play opened over the weekend. It runs through February 28th. You can get details and information about how to get tickets on our website, radiowest.kuer.org, or you can call 801-581-6961. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.